right, everyone. It is, oh my God, February 5th, Wednesday, 2020. We still do not have the results, everyone, from the Iowa caucus. This, of course, is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and our wonderful producer, Ken Barnes. It's lovely outside, which is good because it means that people can participate in whatever kind of political activity they need, because all the candidates have now shown up in New Hampshire and are getting ready to court the New Hampshire voter, especially the undeclared voter, which is about 42% of the vote and can swing either way. And what's the point of picking up a Republican ballot? But I do want to let you know, as I was talking to Ken, just as we were about to come on the air, it just was reported that Doug Jones of Alabama will vote yes on both articles of impeachment. And there was a real question as to whether he would be willing to do that, given the fact that Alabama is such a strong Trump state. But I hope that last night offended him too. I hope that last night. I mean, anyone who had a pulse should be offended. Everyone else who loves theater and political theater, they have to give Donald Trump credit because it was the most unbelievable, over-the-top political theater. SNL was jealous. I'm telling you, SNL could not have done as effective a job as Donald Trump did, because last night was all about audience and TV and theater. It was not about truth. It was not about facts. It was playing to emotion. And he just literally hit every button. It's incredible.
And actually, speaking of TV, you know, the audience that he was playing to, the Republican side of Congress, was like the Saturday Night Live audience. Mm-hmm. They're just all over the place,
right,
cheering and chanting. It was like a political rally.
Oh, it was a political rally.
But it was a parody of a State of the Union. The reference to SNL is really a good one, because it was just like a complete parody of how democracy should work, how statesmanship, how leadership should look.
All
and
it was missing
just turned it into this horror show.
Well, and all it was missing was like, you know, people singing and the music in the background. And I wrote on my Facebook page, I think we need to make this a State of the Union into a musical. And then I realized we have it. And the musical is Springtime for Hitler. I mean, the producers, remember the story of the producers is such a great story because it's the story of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You can't even imagine all the hate being spewed and all the lines. And then you hear the applause. And that's like their producers going, we're supposed to lose money. Why is it supposed to be not successful? Springtime for Hitler was supposed to offend. And instead, it got a rousing way. And I'm watching it, and all I kept thinking was Springtime for Hitler, because it felt more like a Nazi rally. I mean, that's exactly how it felt last night. And people are saying, you know, but at least you didn't mention impeachment. I went, oh, my God. And that's the gift. I mean, like, oy, oy, oy.
And the Republicans are chanting USA, USA. This is what the USA stands for.
This
parody
evil
of everything that we should be standing for. And it's like a hockey game, you know.
Oh, it was.
They're cheering for their guy against the enemy.
And they loved it because people were like ready. And they were actually almost ready for them to start fighting on the ice, you know.
Yeah.
It was like I was waiting for that
to
happen.
Get out the sticks.
So let me just read you one quick thing, because the Rush Limbaugh piece last night was just – I was like so over the top and so mind-blowing. And Ken, I read you this morning. What does science-denying, racist-spewing, hate-mongering Rush have in common with Georgia O'Keeffe, Duke Ellington, Jonas Salk, Helen Keller, Neil Armstrong, and Mr. Rogers? Yeah, it kills me too. The Medal of Honor. That is just – it is just – I'm beside myself. All right, I'll be caught.
Yeah.
Anyway
– and that's what our country has become in this election. I don't know why more of the real public doesn't see it this way, but really it's a referendum on what the United States of America stands for. Are we that kind of Springtime for Hitler country, the USA, USA, we're going to hit you with our high sticks and hate-monger everybody else? Or is it the Statue of Liberty, where we are – this is the place where people's dreams are fulfilled, where we welcome immigrants and we treat everybody, whatever your color, your gender, your sexual preference, with respect and dignity?
Right.
I mean
– the infrastructure we're building is where we're deepening the moat. We're taking up the drawbridge. I mean, this really – he wants to be a monarch.
And we're putting alligators in.
Exactly. It's so funny because we're going to grab Harold Meyerson. He just sent me a new piece.
Yeah.
Trump – sanitized for the occasion on the stump, the State of the Union as reality TV. He just sent it to me. So he must be listening to us talking, knowing that of course we'd be talking about this.
And with his typewriter going at the same time.
Exactly. So everyone, let's grab Harold. So Harold Meyerson is the founding editor of the American Prospect. He was a regular writer at the Washington Post. We get him on many occasions, but he has a series of articles that I grabbed him for. The first two I actually posted on our Facebook page as well as when I sent out our email. But of course, you know that there'll be more than that. And sure enough, he delivers because he had to respond to the State of the Union. He also responded to what happened in Iowa. And he's been sort of looking at sort of how does the media cover this campaign and this president. So I think it'll be kind of fun to begin to have this conversation with him. And I have not had a chance yet to read Harold's new piece on his reaction to the State of the Union. But as you heard me, all it was missing was music, and then we would have had the musical because it was theater. It was not policy. It was lies. It was not facts. It was done to pander to fear. It was all campaign and no content, and just kind of shocking. But there was a lot of schmaltz. I mean, you do want to see a little black girl get a chance at a good school, but charter schools aren't the answer for most black kids in America. Good schools are the answer for most black kids in America. You do understand someone serving in the military and being away from his family, and it was, you know, charming that he was able to come home. But think of the thousands that are not, you know, and then you see the young man who wants to be part of one of the Space Corps, and his 100-year-old grandfather becomes a colonel? I don't know. It's and of course the Rush Limbaugh piece. That's the piece that still is just shocking about Rush. It's just shocking. Anyway, with no further ado, we have three articles to talk to Harold Meyerson about. There's too much content coming in at the same time, Harold. I'm just telling you. If you go to theprospect.org or prospect.org, you can read everything that Harold writes, or you can listen to the radio because we grab him and we mine him for everything he writes. Welcome to the program, Harold.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
So let's start with last night first. We got to backtrack because, you know, that's the most prescient. I told everyone that it was a musical and it felt more like Springtime for Hitler than it did a State of the Union address. But it was, you know what it was? It was, I can say these letters because I can't say these words. It was an FU speech. It was like he was on steroids because every hate, everything that he knew would unnerve at least the non-crazy Republican side of the party, he used effectively. And it was just scary because it was a wish list and he checked off every box.
He checked off every box and he made a lot of false claims for the economy. I particularly loved, among other things, talking about working people's wages going up, which is largely a function of minimum wage hikes in Democratic states and cities that Republicans universally oppose.
That's
so,
right.
You know, I mean, it wasn't only an FU speech, but not by Trump standards, but by the standards of a normal speech, it was a very chutzpah-laden speech. I mean, claiming credit, you know, the old line that Ann Richards used about George H.W. Bush.
Yeah.
But civil no
born on third base and claimed he hit a triple. You know, the economic recovery was engineered by the Obama administration, not flawlessly, but fundamentally. And Trump, you know, depicts that period as one of squalor, whereas it was one of essentially recovery, and it just has continued, and he sort of rewrites in best Stalinist history tradition what came before.
So I have a favor to ask of you, because I didn't think about that, but this is so true, and that is that you saw states across the country and cities across the country raising the minimum wage, and I mean significantly, to $10,
sure,
to $12, to $15.
In California and New York.
Right. So here's my question. Has anyone crunched the numbers to show that rising income is virtually like 85 or 90% attributable to increasing that minimum wage to something incredibly significant, closer to a living wage, because I think this needs to be the bumper sticker. This needs to be the billboard, because you're absolutely right. Republicans have fought against it, and yet look what this does. He gets to grab it, and it has nothing to do with his economy. It has to do with raising the minimum wage.
I don't know that anyone has quantified it, but just between us, the American Prospect actually sublets our office space from the Economic Policy Institute. So as soon as I get off the
phone, do that.
I'm going to walk down the hall and talk to Thea Lee, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute, and say, hey, this is something we need. So
absolutely. Please. Okay. No. And I think I want people to hear this because I was on Fox News about 6 months ago. You're going to love this part of the story, Harold, because it goes directly into the minimum wage story. So I'm on Fox News, and I reminded the audience on Fox News that every single time the minimum wage has been on the ballot referendum, whether it's a blue state or a red state, it has won. It has
absolutely.
Won. And they called me on it, and they said, that's not true. And I made them fact check me in real time. And they fact-checked me in real time, and they had to go, well, but I said, what's the fact? What's the fact? In real time. And they said, she's right.
Of course. I mean, it passes in Florida. It passes in Utah. It passes everywhere.
I mean,
real people, as such, are in favor of having a somewhat decent level minimum wage. It passes everywhere.
It does. And yet last night, I think, was so frightening. It was so frightening because you can't believe that everything from the Rush Limbaugh Medal of Honor to bringing up the props of the people that were in the audience. I hate those people, and I love them as people. I hate how they're being used as props for his evil agenda, which will undermine all the hope of those people he's using. That's the
Absolutely.
Part that's so cruel.
Yeah.
It was cruel what he did last night.
Yeah. He also took it beyond. He sort of took it into the realm of TV entertainment with reuniting the soldier's family, with giving a kid a scholarship. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, he also purchased the serial rights for when this is streamed. He will get royalties, you know, sort of like you do with a TV production, which I'm, you know, that much I can count upon him doing, delivering on issues of public concern. Not so much, to put it mildly.
Exactly. So I have been covering Iowa and the caucus for 20 years. I'm lucky, Artie. I was on Pacifica the night of the returns in Iowa. And, of course, the first time they did a hit with me was about 7:30, and I was kind of perky and upbeat. By 11:45, when they were supposed to call me again to sort of do a recap, and they hadn't called at 11:45, and then at 12:15, and then at 12:30. By the time I got on at 12:30, the idea that we were like morose is an understatement. But let me just say something, Harold. Not only am I unhappy about the fact that we don't have results, I have two questions for you. One is that they predicted the largest turnout ever. It didn't happen. The numbers did not even come close to what happened in 2008 with Barack Obama. What we did see happen was there was a spike in young people participating. But if there was a spike in young people participating, it was at the expense of everybody else not showing up.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, no one has sort of done a survey of why people didn't show up. I have, you know, some guesses. I mean, I think there might be two factors. One is that given that no candidate really got more than a quarter of the vote, basically, there was no, you know, one popular hero or heroine to which people were galvanized. They each have very distinct constituencies. Three theses. Two, I think there may have been a kind of weariness but by the complete saturation of Iowa setting in, which may have produced a backlash. Just as, you know, one of the things about impeachment is there's a certain kind of weariness of going over this stuff when you know it's not going to change anything. Trump
exactly.
is not going to be convicted.
Exactly.
That could have produced some resistance. And three, I think, you know, the level of people who really don't know who is the best person to put up against Trump probably also kept some people home because you're really going to commit yourself to go out there when you're not sure who the person is. And so I think it might be some combination of those three factors.
Well, I'm going to throw one more factor in, Harold.
Make it four.
And I'll make it four. And here's the other factor, Joe Biden. And the demographic that didn't show up was Joe Biden's demographic. The demographic that didn't show up is the ones that supposedly would be the most comfortable with him, that feel the most secure with him, where when you at least look at the national polls, that's where he is so successful. But what scared me about the caucus was he couldn't even get them to show up in a caucus. And historically, caucuses have been for old white people. That's the only people that show up in caucuses. So they have a history and a muscle of doing the caucus. But for whatever reason, in 2020, that history and that muscle had no inspiration to show up. That speaks horribly, yeah, I think, for Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, two things. Biden doesn't inspire. And a lot of people who would have supported him were convinced that he just didn't have what it took to go the distance. And so they didn't go the distance and show up for the caucus. They might not have been enchanted by the other candidates, so they stayed home.
Yeah.
This is all a bad sign. Now, we have to hope and we believe that based on things like the 2018 midterms, that simply voting directly against Trump turns out our people in large numbers. But certainly the Iowa caucuses didn't turn out people in large numbers.
It didn't. I mean, and there is one other thing, since you have the Economic Policy Institute down the street or down the road or down the hallway.
Down the hall.
Down the hall. It's even more convenient. I should be, like, working with you. But here's the other thing that I was thinking about, and I'm going to call Iowa about it. So as we've been listening to whatever the returns are crawling in, 52% and 61% and 71%, whatever it is, one of the things I keep hearing about, and this is so interesting to me, we know that the Republican Party has been embracing the idea of voter suppression. And there's a group that they want to target. They want to target poor people and young people. So they don't want college students to participate because they're too left. And they don't want poor people or people of color to vote because maybe they'll also vote, as a Democrat.
Right.
So the voter suppression has been the sort of definition of the Republican Party. The Democratic Party, however, says, no, we want everyone to come in. We want everyone to participate. One of the things, Harold, that you keep hearing over and over again as they're talking about awarding delegates for the caucus is that college towns get lower weight than the rest of the state. So you could do incredibly well in Iowa City. You could do incredibly well in Ames. But even though you have the numbers, Iowa City and Ames get less weight when it comes to being awarded delegates. That seems a little bit like voter suppression to me.
Certainly one vote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but I have read, I don't have this from first-hand experience, knowledge, but I have read that the caucuses give a little more delegate weight to smaller rural counties. So it's not just college towns, it's Des Moines and Cedar Rapids that are underrepresented as well. And in an odd, unfortunate way, it's kind of a very minor league version of what's wrong with the United States Senate. I mean, even if there were no Mitch McConnell.
Exactly.
That it represents acreage and not just one person, one vote.
Acreage.
And that's a problem.
No. I mean, I'm doing Chris Hayes' show tomorrow night. And one of the things I keep watching is MSNBC has these little vignettes where they put them into a commercial. And Chris Hayes hates the Electoral College. He says, let's elect presidents just the way we elect everybody else. One person, one vote. And as I was watching the returns in Iowa, all I kept thinking about was the Electoral College and everything we hate about it and the idea of voter suppression and representing, giving people with, a rural content numbers, but not with human being numbers, some sort of engagement. And I think we need to write about that, too. That is another problem with the caucus.
And remember the origins of the Electoral College. It was they didn't want to do the popular vote because there were more white people who were the only ones that could vote in the North than the South. So the slaveocracy of the South insisted on doing it by states in which slaves would be counted at 60% of an individual to boost the clout of the South more than a simple popular vote. So not only is the Electoral College conceptually flawed against majority rule, It's also historically damned by its very existence is the result of slaveholders wanting to maximize their power.
Well, and again, I think that's where the prospect could write something like, so Iowa Democratic Party, why did you embrace this flawed system? Here we
Although,
know.
You know, I do think this is probably the last of Iowa going first and hopefully the last of caucuses in general.
Yep.
Since, you know, caucuses have a very small electorate. And if you want a more representative and sizable number of Democrats choosing the nominee, do a primary, for God's sake.
Right. So let's put a button on the conversation on Iowa this way. So there were four speeches coming out of Iowa, and the four speeches were Mayor Pete, I won. There was Elizabeth Warren. Well, we have interesting numbers, and we're grateful for everyone that participated. Bernie gave his typical speech. I don't know. It didn't matter whether it was a caucus or a primary or the middle of Minnesota.
Right.
And then you had Joe Biden, who was just grateful that the numbers hadn't come in. I mean, I think that's really kind of how it sort of played out. And Amy Klobuchar, who keeps talking about being punching above her weight, you know?
Right.
So those
she
are the five.
Doesn't weigh very much, though.
I know, it doesn't, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about what Mayor Pete did, which felt very Clinton-esque. And remember when Clinton
yes,
came in the second?
That's what I was thinking, too. When he finished, I think, was it third in New Hampshire?
No, he came in second. No, he came in second after Paul Tsongas.
And he said he was the comeback kid.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
packaging.
Yep.
And I'm certain someone on the Buttigieg campaign remembered this and said, look, so we don't have the numbers yet, but let's go out and claim victory. It worked for Clinton in 92. Maybe it'll work for us now.
Exactly.
And to a certain degree, it did work for them.
It did work, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, on the one hand, he did have a very good night by the standards of how people were doing in Iowa. On the other hand, to use this term for the second time in this conversation, it was a display of industrial strength chutzpah. I mean, there were no numbers, and he was claiming victory. But, you know, I think to be the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, running for president, you need industrial strength chutzpah.
Well, and I also reminded people yesterday on my Facebook page that he was actually more notorious in a maybe positive way for the Democratic National Committee because he ran for chairman of the DNC. It turned out that Barack Obama put Perez in instead and weighed in, but he was known as a phenomenon then. Everybody was like, wow, who's this kid? Who's this kid? Who's this kid?
Yeah.
So he
yeah.
really established himself with the Democratic National Committee folks and the big money donors as someone to watch and someone to massage moving forward. So I see a lot of what he would have done with the DNC was something he did the other night in Iowa. It was definitely a Clinton move. But it did work for Clinton. So who are we to say that was stupid?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about Bernie's response. Because Bernie's response, I feel what the only problem I have with Bernie is it doesn't matter where he is or what the venue is, we can both give a speech.
Yeah. Well you know, and his speech doesn't really vary from venue to venue or more seriously from situation to situation.
That's my point.
I think you need, you know, there are special occasions and then there's your regular stump speech. And on the special occasion, I think you need to pull back and say more. I think you need to say, well, this is this moment in American history and a little more on here's where we want to go and not simply here's what's screwed up, what's we're going to fix. You know, a little more personal. And just because anyone who follows politics at all has heard Bernie's stump speech. I mean, you know, since 2015.
Exactly.
And I say this as someone who loves Bernie, but if I was working on his campaign, I would, try to
mix it up,
goose it up,
yeah.
on special occasions. And the Iowa caucuses, even when they don't have a result, is a special occasion.
This is so cute, Harold. So when he came to my house in 2015, in January of 2015, to talk about running for president, I remember saying to someone afterwards, they said, well, how well do you know Bernie? I said, I could have given that speech. That was 2015.
Yeah,
and so I'm hearing this, and it's not like the content isn't valuable. But
it's very valuable.
It is very valuable. It's very valuable. And then last but not least, we do have to talk a little bit about Elizabeth Warren. So what is Elizabeth Warren's hope going forward? Once again, you get the feeling she is everyone's second choice.
Yeah, and that's a tricky position. But, you know, I mean, so long as no one is getting more than 25 or 30% coming out of elections, if she can maintain funding, she can hang on. I think she's now in a position where if you think Bernie is too unelectable, and you think Buttigieg and Bloomberg are too close to Wall Street, or in Bloomberg's case, personify Wall Street, there's Elizabeth sort of in the middle, and that's why she's everyone's second choice. That is a tricky position to be in,
right?
But you know, if she can, and this is the big if she can maintain funding, it's not a terrible position to be in, particularly if, as has not happened since 1952, no one has a majority of the delegates going into the convention. Then you get a situation that hardly anyone alive can draw an experience about. But,
right.
That might be a viable position, at least certainly in terms of deal-making with the Sanders people, to get a majority.
Yeah, but even before the convention, sure, a brokered convention is not likely, maybe, but after another four primaries are done, she may still have standing power and be more of a compromise candidate. Sort of like the Iowa caucuses, when everybody whose candidate gets blown out then flows to you.
If
she's everybody's second choice, then in subsequent primaries, they may come to her.
All right, so last but not least, if I were Elizabeth Warren, I would play in South Carolina her speech to all the women of color that happened in Houston, where all the candidates were there, and the person who got the greatest response of those women of color from around the country was Elizabeth Warren. And since we know that Biden is damaged, since we know that Bernie has still some issues with black voters, although not young black voters, and we know that Mayor Pete is like tracking 1%, she should really deliver that to South Carolina and say, of all the candidates, this is what you know about me, and this is what I know about you. So let's do this together.
She should. And by the way, in California polls, which is the largest state that votes on Super Tuesday, Bernie has a clear lead among Latino voters, who are a sizable share of the California electorate. So, there are a lot of mysteries that lie before us, and we'll see where they go.
Thank you so much, Harold, for holding my hand and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Always a good time.
All right. Bye-bye, Harold.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Harold Meyerson is the editor of The American Prospect. You can go to prospect.org to read all his fabulous pieces. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. That was the day that Ida Bremen was killed while she stood up for the rights of working people in Rochester, New York. Ida was born in Russia to a Jewish family. She came to the United States fleeing persecution in her homeland. Her family came to Rochester because it was a thriving center of the U.S. garment industry. Seeking a better life, Ida's father joined the Brotherhood of Tailors. In January, garment workers in New York City had gone out on strike. Factory owners in the Big Apple decided to send work to Rochester in an effort to avoid the striking workers. Unions were forbidden in the Rochester garment industry. Union leaders from New York City came to Rochester, asking them to stand up against the factory owners. The workers in Rochester agreed to support the strike, but they wanted union recognition, the 8-hour day, and a pay raise. Ida and her father were among the first to walk off the job. Ida joined picketers in front of a sweatshop on Clifford Street. The picketers were there to protest the shop's workers who were not taking part in the strike. The shop owner, Valentine Sauter, fired a rifle into the crowd of picketers. Ida was struck by the boss's bullet and killed. She was only 18 years old. That night, she was supposed to have her engagement party. The community was outraged. 5,000 people attended her funeral. Mass rallies were held across the area. While no one was ever held accountable for her death, Ida's murder became a rallying cry for the striking workers. They continued to fight until April, when they won the right to join a union.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
A New York City startup is using potato peels, apple cores, and rotten tomatoes to help farmers grow fresh fruits and vegetables.
We take produce waste from food distributors and food processors, anything that can't go to a food bank or farm.
Tania Pina is the founder and CEO of Renewable. The company converts food waste into organic fertilizer pellets that can be used in indoor hydroponic farms. She says when dissolved in water, the pellets
make the nutrients immediately available to the plant, really kind of mimicking biological nutrient systems outdoors.
So she says the technology can help make it easier to grow organic food indoors in urban areas, where fresh local food is often scarce. And it helps the climate. It keeps food out of landfills, where it would otherwise decompose and release methane, a potent greenhouse gas. And it could reduce the need for synthetic fertilizers, which create a lot of carbon pollution when they're manufactured. So far, the company has facilities in New York City and Rochester, New York, and plans to expand to the West Coast. Pina hopes to eventually help cities across the country use their food scraps to grow local organic food. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Ken Barnes picks our music. Oh my God, Exodus. Oh my God. And remind our audience whose rendition of Exodus
is. This is the theme from Exodus by Quincy Jones and his orchestra. Before he was a producer, he was actually a jazz man himself.
Yeah, exactly.
And a fabulous one at that. The Exodus was the refugee ship that brought Holocaust refugees to Israel.
Right, right. And we're talking about refugees and we're talking about the Holocaust and we're talking about the Trump administration. So let me start this way. Here's the headline. And we've been talking a lot about public charge. Have you noticed how much we've been talking about public charge in the last couple of days? We talked about it with coronavirus. We talked about it when the Supreme Court basically re-embraced it. We talked about it with our immigration hub person, Tyler Moran. And so, of course, since it's on the front of my brain, as soon as I went to theconversation.com and I saw this piece, I realized, oh, my God, I have to do this as well. The title was Supreme Court Allows Public Charge Clause That Kept Nazi-Era Refugees from the United States. Joining us on the line is the author of this piece that is posted at theconversation.com. Laurel Leff is an associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University. She was formerly a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and the Miami Herald and an editor with the American Lawyer Media, Inc. and the Hartford Courant. She teaches undergraduate courses in news writing, media, law, magazine writing, and law reporting. And I think I should take your course. Laurel, thank you so
much. I also now teach a course on America and the Holocaust. So
well,
I would add that.
Well, add that to the that's part of your. I was going to go on and on and on, but I couldn't want to get there. So I pulled out a couple of nuggets. I just want to start with this one, and then I'm going to let you go. I mean, not go, but let you talk. And it was you wrote as someone who studied European Jews' attempts to escape Nazi persecution and immigrate to the United States, the administration's evocation of the public charge clause is chilling. And as I read that and then read the rest of your piece, I posted it on Facebook. I said I want every rabbi and cantor to share this piece with their congregation. I want everyone to read this piece. I want to remind people about how we have creatively used our inhumanity to others in ways that now we have regrets about. But God forbid.
But not regrets enough to not do it again.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So walk us through this.
A very key point.
A very key point. So walk us through this history lesson you give us and why this was so chilling for you as you realized it brought back all this knowledge and memory and said, don't do this again.
Yeah. I mean, I think just the headline piece of it is I knew from my work on America and the Holocaust that the primary way that the, frankly, FDR administration and the State Department kept too many, in their view, Jewish refugees from coming to the United States between 33 and 41 was through use of the public charge clause. So that, I mean, anyone who's studied this history knows that. So to then, in the summer, realize that the Trump administration was using the exact same provision was just, I mean, I remember saying to my husband, I can't believe they're using the public charge clause. I can't believe they're using the public charge clause. So the history is that the public charge clause has existed in immigration law since 1882, and then it was revamped a little bit in 1917. But between those years and 1930, those five decades, it was mostly interpreted to mean that it would only keep from immigrating people who were physically or mentally disabled. Everybody else was just assumed would not become a public charge when they would come to the United States. So very, very few people were blocked entry because of this clause in the statute. Then in 1930, the Hoover administration decided that one of the reasons why unemployment after the stock market crash was so high was perhaps because of immigrants, or perhaps it was just another example of scapegoating. But whatever the reason, they decided to issue a press release. And in the press release, they instructed their consulates abroad, who were the ones who issued the visas, that they must deny visas to anyone who probably could become a public charge when they got to the United States. And it was, there was more verbiage around it, but what it meant was just that vague, right? It was because the question is, how do you know if someone is going to become a public charge once they get to the United States? They had no criteria whatsoever. And but it was very effective. So the idea was we did have quotas, and lots of people have talked about the quota limits on a country-by-country basis, which was a little over 25, it was almost 26,000 for Germans. Mm-hmm. But what the goal was by this public charge clause was to keep the number of people who were admitted to the United States below the quotas. Right. And they were able to achieve that very effectively. So in the very first year that they started reinterpreting the public charge clause as a way of denying entry to immigrants, to deny them visas, immigration under the German quota dropped 90%. Now, when Roosevelt became president in 1933 and Hitler became chancellor of Germany just a few months before that, he could have... It's not even clear this was an executive order or just, but he could have changed it. He could have said, no, you know, we're not going to do this, or he could have done what Harvard professor Felix Frankfurter suggested, which was to make an exception for people who were being politically or racially persecuted or religiously, but he didn't. And so throughout this period, when there were, you know, first 600,000 desperate German Jews, and then, of course, it spread throughout Europe, so there were probably at various points almost a million people, mostly Jews, who wanted to immigrate to the United States. The State Department denied visas primarily on the basis of the idea that these people would become a public charge, were probably going to be a public charge once they came to the United States. And again, like the current language, there is no time limit. So if you, 20 years from now, they decide you're going to be a public charge, that would be a basis for denial.
And there's no guidelines as to how they decide that you're likely to be a public charge.
Well, so when we're talking about the 1930s, it was before the Administrative Procedure Act. So there wasn't really a requirement on the part of the State Department to promulgate rules on it like they have to do now. So trying to give some more meat to it, it was just this language. What the State Department officials did was they communicated to their consuls abroad, mostly not even sort of what the criteria should be, because the criteria varied widely. I mean, some consulates said you had to have so much in assets. Some said that you could get an affidavit from a close relative. Some said you could get an affidavit from a close relative, but the relative had to have X number of assets in order to provide the affidavit, and then even then they could deny you entry. So it was both, you know, varied from, you know, Hamburg to Stuttgart to Rotterdam, and it also, even within a particular consulate, it could very much vary from official to official. And what's interesting about that is that was deliberate in some ways.
Yes.
That, I mean, first of all, the discretion was given to the individual officers, but in some of the internal communications, what they said is they liked to keep it vague, because then it gave people could be denied very easily, and you never had to provide a reason. I mean, the only reason that we know some of the rationales that they offer is because refugees who are working with the National Refugee Service or the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society or the Quakers, who is very involved in refugee work, they would complain to them and say, look what this consulate did. I have, you know, my uncle has this much in assets and he's willing to sponsor me, and they still turn down my application, or I'm a doctor, of course I'll be able to practice in the United States, and they turn down my application. So that's how we know what their rationales were and how varied they were. But the importance of it, and maybe I'm talking a little bit too much here, but and I think this is one of the parallels.
I'm about to interrupt. It's okay. Keep going.
Okay, is that they could do this without having to go through the legislative process.
Right. And so as I'm listening to you talk, and I actually pulled that section out of your article and posted it on Facebook, because I wanted to remind everyone, remember how Michael Cohen said Donald Trump speaks in code?
Mm-hmm,
okay,
right.
That's all that kept going through my head. So let me just read you exactly what you write, because I want people to hear this, because this is about how an administration can effectively tell you what result they want, whether it's in writing or not, whether it's in regulation.
Right.
You write the following. Top State Department officials made clear what it was they wanted: to reduce immigration as much as possible. They also made clear that consulars' officials' careers, hinged upon accomplishing that goal. The State Department largely succeeded, primarily by relying upon the public charge clause. Historians who have researched its use agree. And then you point out, and this is the number that really relates to the Holocaust, about 200,000 refugees from countries under Nazi domination were admitted to the U.S. as immigrants. About 550,000 could have been allowed under existing U.S. quotas. Only once during the 12 years of the Nazi regime in 1939 was the German quota filled. In all other years, the quota ranged from as low as 7% to 70%. And of course, we don't know what happened to those individuals, but everything that you wrote, it just felt like I could just feel the administration today was just literally looking at this as, okay, this is what we use as our roadmap for how we're going to behave right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're that aware of the history, but I'm not even sure it matters that much. I mean, this is the history. This was the way it was used. And at least some of the overriding things, I think, are very clear. I mean, you know, at one point during this period, one of the State Department officials was testifying about whether or not the quotas should be reduced. And he said, you know, we don't really need to reduce it. We're able to accomplish what we want by using administrative methods, and it stays under the radar. We don't have to, you know, and at the time, the head of the immigration committee was a man named Samuel Dickstein, who was a Jew from Brooklyn. So trying to get something through the Congress was hard. This was relatively easy.
Well, let's remember who's writing a lot of this toxic stuff is Stephen Miller.
And not that I think
that Stephen Miller is a historian, but Stephen Miller is also a Jew. And I want to remind everyone that he should read this article. But then again, I don't think it matters to him, because the point of the matter is that who does he want to keep out right now? And that's really what and you kind of got that sense even last night during the State of the Union. You know, this is about drawing up the drawbridges and talking about the people that committed all these horrific crimes and pointing about the number of people that could not come in. And this just continues to aid and abet that conversation. The only problem I have with the public charge rule, on top of what you wrote about, though, Laurel, is that the public charge rule also chills people that are legally here now.
It's about taking advantage of services that they're entitled to, but they're afraid to use, because then it might keep them from changing their status to something more permanent. Yes, that's definitely an element of it that is very worrisome.
So,
I would agree.
So as you looked at the reviving of the public charge clause, you mentioned before that it was pretty sort of not specific. So you could drive a Mack truck through. It was basically as arbitrary and capricious as the person who was sort of making the decision.
Yeah.
Have we gotten a little bit better, that there has to be something that's a little more real and a little more positive? You have an ability to challenge, because if nothing else, you can say, I checked off every damn box. So what is the rationale other than the color of my skin, other than my religion, other than the country I come from? But I'm just trying to figure out whether there's something that we can fight back on.
Well, I mean, there are 20 factors, so that's very different. So in the 1930s, the language really was just likely to become a public charge. So there wasn't anything that filled it out more specifically. I mean, at some point there was the ability to provide an affidavit, but that was probably it in terms of anything more concrete. And even then, they were still denied. I think the problem, though, is that it's still the discretion lies with a lower official. And while you start off with some very specific things, like they had to have made use of, you know, of a non-cash benefit, food stamps, or Section 8 housing,
right.
12 months over 36 months. So that does seem, you might disagree with it, but that does seem to be at least something concrete. But then as you move through it, it becomes more and more ambiguous. And you can also take into account things like English language proficiency, and do you have health insurance, and are you in the future likely to become a public charge? So I would hope that there would be more concrete reasons that if you fulfill them, you might be able to challenge it. But, you know, the part of the rule says that this is up to local officials to decide. And there's, I think, enough in there to and I think the Migrant Policy Institute has done some work in looking at most recent people who've gotten green cards, and found that 69% of the ones who've come in and gotten green cards in the last 5 years would have had at least one negative factor. It probably is not surprising, and is probably intentional, mm-hmm. that when you look at people who come from Asia, 41% have two or more negative factors. If you look at people who come from Mexico or Central America, it's up to 60% have two or more factors. So it's also another way of keeping out not just poorer people, which is part of the goal, but also people from particular regions,
right.
which, you know, was part of the intent, I think, during the 1930s as well. That, you know, this really got going, even though it had been implemented before the rise, before Hitler became chancellor. But the State Department pursued it with such ferocity when it was clear what they were doing is they were keeping primarily Jewish refugees
Absolutely.
From coming to the United States.
And so as we talk about the horrific history, and we then bring it up to the current horrific present. I just want – there was one thing that just sort of jumped out at me again at your wonderful piece of the conversation. Please, everyone, read it, read it, read it. It's on my Facebook page. You write, applicants who have enough money – this is today – enough money to cover any reasonably foreseeable medical costs.
Right.
So let me just say something. As the highest driver of bankruptcies in America are medical costs, almost no American under the bottom 80% could not actually answer the question that they had enough money to cover any reasonably foreseeable medical costs, which just gives you the idea that this is just a huge hole. It is a huge hole.
I don't think – I mean, unlike only maybe Mike Bloomberg, right,
could answer
that in a way, say, yes, no matter what happened, I could definitely take care of my medical costs. Everybody else, I think I would have to say no, right?
And that's what makes it so terrifying as we see this. And I've told this story before, because you look at all these things and you go, well, maybe they're reasonable. Well, maybe they're reasonable. And then I'm going, I've had 25 jobs in the course of my lifetime. How many times have I lost my job? How many times have I lost my health care? How many times have I had to go on welfare? I mean, you look at your own personal life. It's not that I'm not a success today. It's not that I haven't contributed today. But these people are basically, I mean, what they're basically saying is you have to be rich and white. I mean, they didn't say it, but in a subtle kind of an interesting way, this is about buying in, which is exactly something that Donald Trump would understand and comprehend.
Yeah, and there's one other thing I want to say about this, and I think one of the reasons why historical analogies can be powerful, which is, I think, you know, somebody like Stephen Miller or other people would say, maybe under their breath, you're right. It was terrible in the 1930s that we kept 300,000 Jews out of the United States who could have qualified under the quota. But they were good refugees, right? That's what makes the difference, right?
Yes.
They were, and whatever we want to attach to that. But the important thing is, in that period, that was not the way they were viewed, right? In that period, you would hear the same kind of rhetoric about them being criminals, about them being communists, about them being radicals, about them being threats to national security, about them wanting to live off of welfare, about them not wanting to serve in the military. I mean, all of the same kind of reasons why you would not want the wave of immigration in the 30s is the same kind of rhetoric. And what we realize, I mean, I think that there's almost no doubt about this, is that wave of immigration, in my view, most waves of immigration, did enormously important things to the United States. It helped us in immeasurable ways, and it's not that and it's not because those were the good ones.
Right. We are a nation of others. We are a nation of others. And others is black, and others is Asian, and others is Muslim, and others. And that's what's just so depressing to me. I read something the other day. We were talking about, you know, the socialist, you know, Bernie Sanders with his Medicare for All. And then I quoted a speech from 1974 by Richard Nixon, you know, and it's like, I'm not going to tell you who said this, And it was Richard Nixon talking about universal health care. And I'm like, again, that's why the language that you talk about from the 1930s is virtually identical to the language that we have today. And again, I want to remind everyone, you put out in your fabulous article at The Conversation, Laurel, that in October, the State Department amended its rules for consular offices to use in issuing visas to be in line with the new public charge interpretation.
And we're still waiting for the Justice Department
to
come up with deportation rulings based on the public charge clause, too.
So there's still so many holes and still so much opportunity. But I'm so glad that you reminded us about this, because this is one of the stories that goes under the radar, because there's such a cacophony out there that we're not focusing on this. You know, we talk about the kids in cages, and in a way, it's horrific, but it's an easier visual. This is more subtle. This is more complicated, and in some ways, maybe even more insidious because of what it ultimately means as a consequence. And from a deportation perspective, it's frightening. And as we're looking at the coronavirus, which is what we were talking about yesterday with the public public charge. I said, imagine if you are representing people in Chinatown in San Francisco or Chinatown in New York or Boston, and there are people there and they may need to access benefits. And now all of a sudden, because of the public charge rule, they're not going to. And what happens if we suddenly see this become a pandemic? We've actually embraced this at the worst possible time when it comes to our national security. So I want people to not only look at the Holocaust, but look at this from another national security perspective.
No, I think, that's absolutely right. And I'm very happy that you were willing to bring this out, because I think, you know, maybe, and this is probably naive, but that's why we continue to do the work we do, that if you understand the way that the insidious way this was used in the past,
right,
it might make you less likely to be willing to tolerate it being used in the same way in the present.
Laura Leff, my airwaves are your airwaves anytime you want to talk. Thank you for writing about this. Thank you for triggering the conversation. And I suspect you'll trigger more conversations in the future. So I appreciate
it. Okay, well, thank you. It was really a delight.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Great.
Laura Leff is an associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University. The title of her fabulous piece, it's at our Facebook page. It's at theconversation.com. Supreme Court allows public charge clause that kept Nazi-era refugees from the U.S. Read it, mine it, share it. And we end with what?
We end with A Day in the Life of a Fool. It's from Manha de Carnaval, a Brazilian bossa nova piece, and it's sung by Harry Belafonte.
I love it. Here we go.
Day in the life of a fool, a sad and a long, lonely day. I walk the avenue and hope I'll run into welcome sight of you coming my way.